Buenos días. Buenos días a todos. Good morning. We are extremely grateful to all of you, and especially to Susan Hack and Richard Wright for the extraordinary effort to be here these days in order to make this worship for Susan Hack. El Premio de Internacional de Cultura Jurídica era uno de los proyectos de la Cátedra de Cultura Jurídica desde su creación en 2009. Estamos en 2020 y hemos tenido 11 años para poderlo hacer sin afectación de coronavirus, pero decidimos esperar hasta el peor momento posible y lo hemos conseguido. Hemos conseguido hacerlo en un momento especialmente difícil, pero hacerlo en cambio con una fortaleza de la cátedra y sobre todo una fortaleza de ánimo muy grande, porque en nuestra primera premiada, Susan Hack, es alguien extraordinariamente querido para nosotros, que ha tenido ya una costumbre, que ha adquirido una costumbre de visitar Girona y de participar en nuestras actividades. Es algo que agradecemos muchísimo, y también de recibir en Miami a algunos miembros de nuestro grupo de investigación o alguna miembro de nuestro grupo de investigación para realizar estancias de investigación allá. Es, como digo, un placer muy grande poder reunirnos hoy, casi con el último suspiro antes de que nos cierren a todos en una cuarentena. Esto tiene algunos efectos incluso sobre la imprevisibilidad del programa. En la medida de lo posible vamos a seguir el programa tal cual está previsto, con dos cambios, que son que la ponencia de Nicola Muffato, que es la siguiente después del coffee break, y la ponencia de Brian Biggs mañana se realizarán por Skype. Por eso tenemos ahí la pantalla, porque ni el profesor Muffato ni el profesor Biggs han podido viajar. Esa es la mínima afectación posible, pero hay alguna afectación mayor posible. Esta noche el gobierno norteamericano ha tomado algunas medidas en torno a los vuelos desde Europa a Estados Unidos que podrían complicar la vuelta a casa de los profesores Hack y Wright. Si fuera así, estaremos viendo esto en estas horas, si fuera así, reduciremos el programa a un solo día y entonces... aparentemente,
con acuerdo con el profesor Wright, las restricciones aplican únicamente
a los que no son americanos o residentes en Estados Unidos, pero el punto es si los vuelos se mantienen o no. Si los vuelos se mantienen, no tendremos problemas. Si los vuelos no se mantienen, entonces habrá que tomar alguna medida que informaremos en estos próximos minutos. En todo caso, lo que sí se mantiene es el inicio de hoy, que es la primera de las ponencias de la profesora Hack, Proof, Probability and Statistics, The Problem of Delusive Exactness, que va a impartir la profesora Hack ahora mismo y sin mayor retraso ya. Le doy la palabra, no sin antes agradecer mucho, mucho, mucho de nuevo tu esfuerzo por acompañarnos.
Okay. Buenos días. Es siempre un placer estar aquí en Girona, y esta vez es también un enorme honor, muy halagüeño. Quisiera empezar agradeciéndoles a todos los organizadores, especialmente al profesor Ferrer y a los participantes. Y otra cosa más, mi rodilla me duele horriblemente. Sí, a veces estoy como esto. Probablemente no es algo que alguien dijo. Probablemente. Entonces, no me atrevo a castigarles con mi acento durante una hora. Entonces, voy a presentar mi ponencia en inglés, tal vez con adiciones en Spanish. Mi universidad. Su universidad. Empiezo con dos citaciones, una de Aristóteles, el otro de Oliver Wendell Holmes. Aristotle. It is the mark of an educated mind to expect that amount of exactness which the nature of the subject admits. Very wise observation. Oliver Wendell Holmes, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. Delusive exactness is a source of fallacy throughout the law. Es una presentación jurídica, naturalmente hay opening remarks. Just as I was thinking about a topic for this paper, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal which said, eek, there are statistics which supposedly show 51% of women surveyed and 12% of men say they have been sexually harassed at work. 51% of women and 38% of men say they have witnessed such harassment. Eek! Eek! I must have led a very protected life. But wait a minute. What were those surveyed told about what constitutes sexual harassment? How many were surveyed? How were they selected? How many were men? How many were women? How likely is someone to say they have been harassed when they haven't? That they have? Haven't when they have. I have no idea. And neither had the Wall Street Journal, and neither had the authors of this survey, so far as I can tell. In short, I was completely puzzled. What do those alarming sounding figures really mean? Please don't worry. No se preocupa. No voy a hablar. I'm not going to talk about sexual harassment. Ugh, qué aburrido. I'm going to talk about the role of statistical evidence in legal proof. And my focus is that delusive exactness of which Holmes writes. Okay. And my argument will be that the law sometimes gets less from statistical evidence than it could possibly give, or asks more of it than it could possibly give. And that the problem of delusive exactness hangs over the whole enterprise. The good news. I will talk about both epistemology and evidentiary procedure, and both about criminal and about civil cases. The not so good news, lo siento, this was written for an event about scientific evidence. I'm not going to say anything about advances in fMRI brain imaging, for example, or the possibility of differentiating the DNA of monozygotic twins. Oh, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. Nor am I going to talk about the 2013 return of Bendectin, the drug at issue in Daubert, to the US market. Nor am I going to talk about the history and the effects of the Supreme Court's Daubert trilogy, or of its Menéndez-Díaz trilogy. I'll say nothing about the word, nothing much about those cases. Here's the structure of my talk. I begin with questions of legal epistemology, then move to issues about DNA random match probabilities and epidemiological evidence in toxic tort cases. And in conclusion, I shall explain why I'm not, of course I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with statistical evidence as such. Of course not. Nor am I suggesting there's anything wrong with the calculus of probabilities. In their own sphere. The point is that sphere is limited. It does not simply absorb the sphere of legal proof. Epistemological backdrop. ¿Puedo decir epistemología? Sí, no es una palabra prohibida. No, okay. Two issues are easily and often and disastrously confused. The role of probabilistic and statistical evidence in legal contexts, and the place of the mathematical calculus of probabilities in understanding the legal concept of proof. These are two quite distinct questions. The confusion derives from two uses of probable. Al menos en inglés. Sí, creo en español también. Sí. One is epistemological. According to the English dictionaries I have consulted, this is the primary sense. That's to say, probable refers to the degree of warrant of a claim by evidence. The degree of justification, the degree of proof, if you like, of a claim by the evidence. And then there's the statistical, for a tendency of some process to produce stable relative frequencies of upshot. The second, the statistical, was initially and is still the characteristic idiom of gamblers. That's actually the first source, gamblers, statisticians, and actuaries. And it's this idiom that the mathematical calculus of probabilities regiments. That's what it represents. Some hope also to use this calculus to quantify the quality of evidence, degree of warrant. Often, relying on reconstruing Bayes' theorem as an epistemological theorem. I think the Reverend Bayes would have been very surprised. I think he would have been astonished to learn what's been made of his little theorem. It was not intended as epistemology. That's the Reverend Thomas Bayes, who proved Bayes' theorem. Talk about posthumous fame, wow. It's an uncontroversial bit of mathematics, right? Nothing controversial about it as a mathematical theorem. It's routinely used to calculate inverse probabilities. But it's turned by Bayesian epistemologists into a means of, quote, updating judgments of warrant in response to new evidence. These are expressions neither of which the Reverend Bayes would ever have used. And there, it's turned by subjective Bayesians into an entire epistemology. It's supposed to swallow the field of epistemology as well as the field of legal proof. On its face, the idea of that the degrees of proof are relative frequencies is just bizarre. I mean, on their face, they look epistemological. Moreover, I don't know how you would establish this here, but in the United States, if you look at jury instructions about how they're to determine degrees of proof, they look epistemological, right? Almost 100% epistemological. I don't know if this is a familiar procedure. En los Estados Unidos, los jueces dan instrucciones a los jurados sobre estándares de prueba y cómo determinar. ¿Sí? Y las instrucciones sobre grados de prueba son casi exclusivamente en términos epistemológicos que soportan las evidencias, las pruebas. ¿Sí? Tienen que considerar no simplemente las pruebas presentadas, pero siempre las pruebas no presentadas, las pruebas absentes. Hay excepciones, pero en muchos casos las instrucciones son epistemológicas. Nevertheless, legal probabilism has a long history and it's still popular. Probably because it seems to offer a nice, simple way to deal with complicated evidence and with especially with statistical evidence. It looks easy. Yay, good, okay, we'll take it. Perhaps also because our preponderance standard, the civil standard, the normal civil standard, is sometimes expressed as more probable than not. Preponderance of the evidence is one form of words. More probable than not is the other. I think the first is less misleading, but the second has really encouraged the probabilists. Some try to put numbers on degrees of proof, and they hope to calculate them mathematically. But I think this idea is hopeless, hopeless. The idea that this is hopeless is associated in the English-speaking world primarily with the work of Jonathan Cohen. I wouldn't share all his arguments. I would also add that Professor Wright has done a good deal in this area and has been, like myself, a critic of probabilism for a long time. Longer than I, actually, as I recently discovered. All I can say is, I am with Thomas Starkey, who wrote in 1843, the idea we could assign numbers to degrees of proof is visionary and chimerical. Well, yeah, okay, I agree. I think it's a mistake to try to give numbers to degrees of proof. I'm also with Richard von Mises, who wrote in 1908 that the mathematical calculus of probabilities has nothing to do with questions like, is there a probability of Germany being at some point in a war with Liberia? You want to put a number on that? Makes no sense at all. Of my many reasons, the simplest is this: that in the epistemological realm of warrant and proof, we don't and we can't have relative frequencies, as the calculus of probabilities requires. Which is why when probabilists try to tell us what their numbers mean, they lapse into near unintelligibility. They will give you a paragraph. Son palabras genuinas, pero no quiere decir nada. That long, meaningless paragraphs about what this is supposed to mean. Okay. Here is an actual example quoted from a probabilist article. The number representing the probability that the defendant is guilty as charged is, we are told, the relative frequency over cases judged similar in the degree of belief they induce in which the defendant is guilty. That must mean the relative frequency over possible but not necessarily actual cases judged similar in the degree of belief they induce in which the defendant is guilty. That's the subjective version. Or the relative frequency over possible but not actually actual cases in which the evidence is similar, in which the defendant is guilty. That's the objective version. doesn't make any sense. How are we to determine which are the similar cases? How are we to determine in which of those cases he was judged to be guilty, in which of those he would not be? It doesn't make any sense at all. This is just nonsense. It's all wrong. It's all wrong. It doesn't understand the structure of evidence. It thinks of evidence as like a chain. It's not like a chain. It's more like a cable. And its structure is not linear, like mathematical proof. It's ramifying like a crossword puzzle. Okay. I'm giving you an epistemological theory in dos diapositivos. And when we, as we ask to determine how reasonable a crossword entry is, you look to what? How well does it fit the clue and any completed intersecting entries? How reasonable are those entries? And how much of the crossword is done? That's all you can do. Right? You've all done crosswords, I hope. Okay. With evidence, we look to how well it supports the claim at issue, how solid it is in itself, and how much of the relevant evidence it includes. Each of those needs explaining. Supportiveness depends on how much the evidence contributes, positively or negatively, to the explanatory integration of the claim with the evidence as a whole. That means, because real explanation requires reference to kinds and laws, supportiveness, and so relevance, depends on facts about the world. Es importante que la relevancia, la pertinencia, depende sobre hechos. Sobre hechos. Por ejemplo, grafología es una teoría loca, a crazy theory, sobre cómo es posible determinar el carácter de carácter. Sí, de carácter de una persona examinando cómo escribe. Well, suppose it's true. Right? I don't suppose it's true. Okay. Jordi, tú puedes estar la persona inteligente. Sí? Yo estoy... la idiota, ¿sí? Yo creo en grafología, tú no. Okay. Estamos empleando una nueva asistente, ¿sí? Yo insisto, tienen que aplicar en handwriting, ¿sí? ¿Tú por qué? Es loco, ¿no? ¿Por qué? No es posible leer. Pero, si grafología es verdadera, estoy en lo correcto. Si no es verdadera, tú estás en lo correcto. You understand? La pertinencia, relevancia, depende sobre hechos sobre el mundo. As our law of evidence allows. It actually, the federal rules of evidence actually say you may be asked to provide a foundation to show relevance. So, if we're assessing statistical evidence, we should ask, how solid are the statistics in themselves? How good are the studies, etc.? What does the statistical evidence contribute to the warrant of the claim at issue in the context of the evidence as a whole? And what potentially relevant information is missing? Legal foreground. Phew, you must be relieved. Lawrence Tribe has a famous paper called Trial by Mathematics, which in my opinion concedes far too much to the probabilists, but at least is critical of legal probabilism. It begins with a case called People versus Collins, an old California case. It is an otherwise routine purse-snatching case in which probabilistic testimony played a major role. Okay. Nobody would remember Collins if it weren't for the role of statistical evidence, which was ludicrous, just ludicrous. The prosecution had rather a weak case against the Collins. I should tell you the story. An old lady was mugged in an alley. Her purse was stolen. She could say only that the robber was a youngish woman with blonde hair in a ponytail. That was all she could remember. An eyewitness, well, a semi-eyewitness, testified he saw this a young blonde woman with her hair in a ponytail jump into a car driven by a black man with a mustache and a beard. Janet and Malcolm Collins were a married couple, he black, she white, and both of them slightly shady characters, I think. They were arrested for this crime. Jumped into a yellow car driven by a black man with a mustache and a beard. They were arrested by, of all people, Mark Furman, the policeman who made such a mess of the evidence in the O.J. Simpson case, who obviously thought, I found a black man and a white woman, that'll do it. The case the prosecution had was pretty weak. So to bolster this case, the prosecution introduced a mathematics instructor from the local community college as an expert witness to testify to the product rule. That's to say, the probability of A and B is the probability of A multiplied by the probability of B, which is always lower than either. Okay. And he said, this instructor, assuming for illustrative purposes, that's already suspicious, assuming for illustrative purposes that the probability of a car's being yellow is 1 in 10, incluendo taxis, of a man's having a moustache is 1 in 3. Tal vez no. Of a girl's having a ponytail is 1 in 10. Of a girl's being blonde is 1 in 3. Of a Negro man's having a beard is 1 in 10. And of an interracial couple in a car is 1 in 1,000. Aha. It followed that the probability of another couple matching the same descriptions was 1 in 12 million. Okay. Which was supposedly mathematical proof of the Collins' guilt. Okay. You may laugh. Nonsense. This is nonsense. First of all, the numbers were made up. Secondly, there was no attempt made to show that they were statistically independent of each other. For that matter, the numbers weren't even relevant unless the eyewitness testimony was credible. If you couldn't believe the eyewitnesses, what was the point of all this? Right? Suppose she was wrong about the car being yellow. And suppose she was wrong about the woman being blonde. Moreover, it was a fallacy to infer from the 12 million to one figure that the probability that Janet and Malcolm Collins were not the perpetrators was 1 in 12 million. That was a mathematical mistake. And anyway, they might have had proof they bought the yellow car only after the robbery. Or there might have been evidence that the robbers weren't local, for example. Okay, all of these were based on, these are the probabilities in California. In California. Well, suppose they came from Nevada. Well, what you see. Nobody ever asked. The prosecution never sorted this out. Never. Okay. The jury convicted. 1 in 12 million? Okay, it's facile. No? No, I did. The Supreme Court of California reversed the ruling correctly. You know, perhaps the Collinses were guilty. I don't know. Actually, I think there's a considerable probability. Malcolm Collins ran away when the police came to the house and lied about where he'd been and had shaved off a previous moustache and beard. But then he'd been in prison before, so he was suspicious of who knows, who knows. Anyway, the Supreme Court of California reversed the ruling. The so-called mathematical proof, it said, had inadequate evidentiary foundation. And it went on. 1968, it went on. Mathematics, a veritable sorcerer in our computerized society, while assisting the trier of fact in his search for truth, must not cast a spell over him. This kind of trial by mathematics is a miscarriage of justice. Me gusta immensamente. Our computerized society in 1968. See? That was the size of a computer in 1968. You may think, well, yes, but that was 50 years ago. Nobody would fall for this kind of thing today. Nobody would accept this kind of thing. But the fact is, when the mathematics gets more sophisticated, the confusions get worse. For example, DNA testimony that the probability of that the match is random is very low can completely blind fact finders to possible flaws in the testing process and to the weight of other evidence. This is probably the worst case of misconduct on the part of the defense that I have ever encountered, actually. It's a British case. No, I do not routinely study British cases, but this one I found by accident and then started to read carefully, and it's what we would call in the US a doozy. It's a real doozy. The jury in the 1995 trial of Dennis Adams for rape was just as much misled by mathematical shenanigans as the jury was in Collins. This time, the source of the trouble was not the prosecution, it was the defense. Unusually, the prosecution's case depended wholly on DNA evidence. They had no evidence that Mr. Adams was the rapist, except a cold hit DNA match, his DNA and the DNA from the victim. Okay. The testimony was that the probability of the match between Adams' DNA and the rapist was random was 1 in 200 million. Pretty big numbers. But Adams had an alibi witness. Granted, it was his girlfriend, but he had an alibi witness. He didn't match the victim's description of her attacker. No, wrong size, wrong color hair. The DNA evidence was kind of, didn't come out too clearly, so we touched it up in ink. We improved it in ink. There was also a 1 in 200 chance that Adam's brother's DNA would also match. To prevent jurors giving this DNA testimony undue weight, very unwisely, the defense chose to force all the testimony into the same statistical mode. Absolute disaster, complete disaster for the defense and Mr. Adams. Suppose they said, we start with 150,000 males in the local area, assumiendo que la violación fue por alguien local. Just assume the rapist was local. I mean, who gets on a train and then goes rape somebody in another city? So, 150,000 males, how many of those were babies or men over 80? I have no idea. But okay. Assuming, for illustrative purposes, that the odds that the rapist was local were 75%, the odds that it was Adams would be 1 in 200,000. Get it? Assuming that the odds that Adams would not match the description if he were innocent were 90%, and the odds that he would not match the description if he were guilty would be 10%, then apply Bayes' theorem, it gives us the odds of 1 in 1.8 million that Adams is guilty. We've already reduced the number a little bit. Still assuming, for illustrative purposes, the odds that he could produce an alibi were 50% if he was innocent and 25% if he were guilty. Applying Bayes again, we get odds of 3,600,000 that Adams is guilty. And now if we throw in the DNA evidence, one chance in 300 million. Sorry, certain to match if he's guilty, one chance in 200 million if he's innocent. Bayes' theorems give us the odds, 55 to 1 that Adams was guilty. Not 200 million to one, but 55 to one. The jury, I suspect they had no idea what was going on with all this mathematics, convicted. The first appeal reversed. The argument was the defense expert trespassed on jury questions about proof. It was not for the defense to tell you what degree of proof you had. While the judge tried to help them understand the defense's argument, he didn't remind them there were other common sense ways of assessing evidence. The poor judge, I think, worked very hard on Bayes' theorem the night before and gave them a little lesson about Bayes' theorem and how all these calculations worked. But he never told them, you don't have to assess the evidence by applying Bayes' theorem and assuming we're talking about probabilities. Never told them that. Adams was convicted again and appealed again. This time, the second appeal affirmed his conviction because this time the court had instructed jurors correctly. There was no legal error. Right? There was very epistemological error. There was enormous epistemological error, but no, that's not the judge's concern. And the judge had instructed the jury correctly. You don't have to use Bayes' theorem. You may if you wish, you need not. Nevertheless, the appeals court warned of the dangers of the Bayesian approach. A recipe for confusion, misunderstanding, and misjudgment. De acuerdo. A recipe for confusion, misunderstanding, and misjudgment. Yes, indeed, I agree. But why? Why? The appeals court didn't say. You know, they had this intuitive grasp, this is a mess, but they had no articulate way of explaining it. First of all, it's even worse than Collins. It's even worse. Not only were these numbers made up, but they couldn't have been given a factual basis. It's perfectly possible to determine how many Californian women are blonde. It's perfectly possible to determine how many Californian cars are yellow. It's perfectly possible to determine how many interracial couples there are in California. All those things could be determined but weren't. But now we're talking about what's the probability that he could produce an alibi if he were innocent? What's the probability he could produce an alibi if he were guilty? Well, we don't know who's innocent and who's guilty. So this is impossible to determine. It's not just they didn't bother. It's impossible. Second, by making jurors impose artificial precision where none is possible, they distracted them from the standard of proof. Right? They're looking for some number when they should be asking, am I beyond a reasonable doubt? It also distracted them from the weakness of the DNA testimony. I don't know how bad it was, and I've not been able to determine how many loci the UK police were testing at this point in time, but they routinely tested fewer than in the US. And there are a whole bunch of relevant questions unanswered, like, where was his brother? The victim said he spoke with a local accent. Well, could we please hear his brother speak and see if he speaks with a local accent too, and so on. What I want to say about this is DNA fingerprinting. Que ironía, no? Es mucho más sólido que fingerprints, que huellas digitales. Mucho más sólido. It's very precise, but it's not always solid or reliable. You get sharp numbers out of it. It doesn't follow from that that it's always reliable. Things can go wrong. As in the case of Raymond Easton, another UK case, who was charged with robbery on the basis of a DNA cold hit. He had an alibi. He was with his daughter. He was too ill with Parkinson's disease to get out of bed. Hello? How did he commit a robbery 100 miles away? The hit was made, I did find out how many in Adams, using only 6 loci. What? There were only 4 in Adams. Dios mío. Ahora, el estándar en los Estados Unidos es 13. That's the standard number, 13. The prosecution only dropped the case against Mr. Easton when Easton's attorney said, I insist we do another DNA test and I want 10 loci tested. Guess what? It wasn't him. I remember almost 20 years ago in a class on scientific testimony inviting a professor of biology to talk to my students about DNA testing. And they asked him, look, Professor Wilson, suppose I were accused of a crime I knew I didn't commit on the basis of a DNA hit. What would you advise me to do? And he replied, get another test with more loci, right? Which was what Mr. Easton's attorney did, and that got him finally released. Moreover, DNA evidence is subject to human error, as Justice Kagan's dissent in Williams versus Illinois reminded us. Oh, okay. There is a trilogy of US cases about the Confrontation Clause issues raised by forensic testimony. They are Melendez-Diaz, Bull Cumming versus New Mexico, and Williams versus Illinois. The question is, do forensic scientists who are going to testify against, who are going to give evidence that's inculpatory of the defendant, do they have to show up in court, or may they just submit an affidavit? Answer in Melendez-Diaz, they must show up. Answer in Bull Cumming, they must show up. Answer in Williams, no, not always. Not in certain circumstances. It's all very unclear. The lower courts are now in a complete mess, I think, about what this means. Justice Kagan dissents from the plurality. Okay, I should tell you the story. In Williams, that's a rape case. There's supposed to be a DNA hit that shows it's the probability that the match is random is very, very low. This is obtained by 2 steps. One is taking samples from the victim and from Mr. Williams and arriving at a profile, taking samples from the victim and arriving at a profile, and then sending this with the profile from Williams to a private laboratory, which then sends back a report saying, yes, there's a match. So there are two bunches of people involved, the local forensic people and the commercial laboratory. Okay, the guy from the local laboratory has to show up. What about the other one? What about the one in the other laboratory? Well, no, sorry, he doesn't have to show up. That's the decision in Williams. Why not? Oh God, please don't ask me. I'm not sure I could possibly explain to you what the rationale is for this, because it's extremely strange. Justice Kagan dissented. Not usually a big fan, but this is a terrific piece of writing, and moreover, she's absolutely right. And I actually use this as an example for my students. You know, you want to get punch in your arguments, come out with a good example first. Right out of the gate, you need a good example. Justice Kagan's dissent begins, think of the case of Mr. Kozak, where a forensic expert was first on the stand and said, yes, there's definitely a DNA match. Then was cross-examined and defended the claim, there's a DNA match, the probability that it's random is very low. Cross-examined, and the next morning says to the judge, Your Honor, may I please take the stand again? This is very embarrassing, but may I please take the stand again? Okay. I hate to tell you this. I just went back and rechecked. We put the wrong label on the sample. What the external laboratory determined was that it was a match between the victim and the victim. Oh, yeah. Okay. We didn't really need reminding. We knew from Brown versus Farwell, for example, where the prosecutor made two DNA missteps. From the probability that the match to Brown is random is 1 in 3 million, to this is the probability that he's the source, and from this to 3 million to 1, he's guilty. Neither of these was correct. Okay, enough DNA evidence for now. It's not only DNA statistical evidence seen in court, there are many other kinds, including epidemiological evidence. My students know no Greek at all. When I say to them, what's epidemiology, they go, we have no idea. Epi from the Greek, upon, demos, from the people, as in democracy, ology, as in study of. Epidemiology studies the occurrence of disease in its population. It's about correlation, it's not about causation, and it's about populations, not about individuals. Get it? But in toxic talk cases, plaintiffs have to prove both general and specific causation. They have to prove this substance can cause this disorder, that's general causation, and in the case of this particular plaintiff, it did cause this disorder. That's hard to do if you have only epidemiological evidence, because it's about correlation, not causation, and it's about populations, not individuals. In two swine flu vaccinations, oh gosh, this is more resonant than it was a month ago. The most recent really bad epidemic of influenza in the US was swine flu in 1976. There was a vaccine against this flu, quickly developed. Unfortunately, it had a bad side effect. Some of the people who took it developed Guillain-Barré syndrome. I don't know too much about it. I do know you don't want it. It starts with tingling in your fingers and your toes, and in 3 weeks you are paralyzed. Okay. In two of these cases, statistical evidence of more than doubled risk. That's to say, statistical evidence that if you have this vaccine, you're more than twice as likely to develop Guillain-Barré syndrome than if you don't have this vaccine. Get it? That was taken to be necessary for proof of specific causation in Cook and sufficient for proof of specific causation in Mankell. Later, this idea got adopted by other courts and eventually sort of trickled into the Daubert trilogy. And you actually find it in Judge Kaczynski's ruling for Daubert on remand for the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court did not decide the case. It decided the standard of admissibility of expert testimony, but not what happened to the Dauberts. Sent it back to the Ninth Circuit. And Judge Kaczynski's ruling depends in significant part on this idea of more than doubled risk and makes it required not only for proof of specific causation, but even for such evidence to be admissible. Oh my God. I got so angry about Judge Kaczynski's ruling. There's an irony here. Judge Kaczynski had to resign, first on account of how they found obscene images on his website, and secondly on account of many complaints of sexual harassment. I got so angry about this, I actually gave an entire class on it last week, the title of which was Judicial Misdirection. This is one of the worst rulings I think I have ever read. I mean, it's full of brilliant rhetoric, all of which is distracting people's attention from the real point. Okay. This was the final ruling on the case from the Supreme on the remand from the Supreme Court, and so it was enormously influential. And this idea, you need proof of more than doubled risk for evidence of specific causation to be even admissible, became very common. It's used as a test by many federal and some state courts. It's a disaster. Okay, I think I need to go back. Why judicial misdirection? Well, Judge Kaczynski comes out of the gate saying, well, look, it's a whole new world after Daubert. Yeah. For us federal judges, the world is different after Daubert. Because now we have to assess whether expert testimony being presented is science, and if so, whether it's good science that uses the correct methodology. And in the nature of the case, there will have been experts on each side testifying, yes it is, no it isn't. Right? This is a very hard job. Yes. So never mind. I mean, we've got to do. We roll up our sleeves and get on with it. Take a deep breath. Do what you have to do. Okay, that sounds like he's going to assess the science, doesn't it? Right. And then he says, well, something very sinister about the scientific testimony offered by all the Bendectin plaintiffs, including the Dauberts. It is all of it litigation-driven. Well, of course it is. When are they going to do this research? Except after the litigation has begun, right? Or as it's beginning. He never mentions that the defendant's research may also have been litigation-driven. Daubert was brought long after Bendectin had been removed from the US market. So why is Merrill Dow still doing it? They're doing it to defend themselves against litigation. While he's at it, he makes an exception in the case of forensic science. It strikes me as crazy. Just crazy. I mean, forensic science is all litigation-driven and potentially biased for that very reason. But then you think he's going to say, here's a new Daubert factor, is it litigation-driven? And defendants, now they're defendants, but the Daubert's testimony would have been ruled inadmissible even under Daubert because it's litigation-driven. He doesn't. He says, all but one of the Daubert's experts is irrelevant. Their testimony is irrelevant, so they're out on relevance. One of them, Dr. Palmer, is actually relevant, I admit. But it's okay. It's relevant, but Dr. Palmer doesn't tell us what his methodology is, so a fortiori, we don't know he has a reliable methodology, so he's out too. Hello, and why are all the others irrelevant? Because they don't claim that the risk is more than doubled. So there is absolutely no serious discussion of the science. None, right? There is mock modesty about, you know, poor us federal judges, we have to think about science. We're not trained for this, but okay, you know, a job's a job, you've got to do what you've got to do. Yeah. That's just mock modesty. And then there's discussion about litigation-driven science, which is not uninteresting, but completely flawed because it's so narrow in its focus on only plaintiffs' expert testimony. And then a decision which is largely based on relevance and not on reliability, which was what all the other stuff was about, and in any case, crucially depends on equating proof of more than doubled risk of developing this disorder if you're subject to this stuff and preponderance of the evidence. Not to mention, it equates the standard of admissibility with the standard of sufficiency, which is a disaster. Okay. However, as Vermont Chief Justice Reber put it, this requires each piece of admissible evidence to be sufficient. That's legally unacceptable. You could never prove a criminal case this way. Never. Beyond a reasonable doubt, this is the eyewitness is correct. Beyond a reasonable doubt, the DNA test is correct. Beyond a reasonable doubt, the car was correctly identified and the license plate come off it. Moreover, a showing of relative risk greater than 2 is not sufficient to meet the preponderance standard. It rests on a confusion of statistical probability with degree of proof. It's just a confusion. Almost done. We say in English, to a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. To those of a formalistic bent, everything looks like a probability problem. Right? They're happily mathematized, the ideas they deal with, regardless. But if, as I've argued elsewhere, there's reason to doubt that degrees of warrant fit the profile of the axioms of the probability calculus, I don't think they do. I think they just don't. Now, in fact, I don't think degrees of proof can be formally regimented at all. I think trying to give numbers to degrees of proof is exactly to fall into the problem that Aristotle saw, that it expects more precision than is possible. If that's right, this is a vain hope. You cannot mathematize everything. Notice what I'm not saying. Please notice what I am not saying. I am not saying there's anything wrong with the probability calculus. It's fine in its place. Nor am I saying there's anything wrong with Bayes' theorem. It's fine in its place. I'm just saying their sphere is limited and Bayesian epistemology is an exercise in delusive exactness. That's precisely what it is. Nor am I suggesting there's anything wrong with statistical evidence as such. We couldn't possibly get by without it in certain kinds of cases. It's essential. It's often useful, it's sometimes essential. Nor am I saying we may not need probability theory to assess the solidity of statistical evidence. I'm just saying, statistical evidence is a variable quality. Oh, look. Think about Merrill Dow's studies of Bendectin. Bendectin was a drug for morning sickness in pregnancy. Okay. If you're conducting an epidemiological study or a clinical trial of such a drug, a reasonable person would distinguish those who were given the drug during the period of pregnancy in which fetal limbs are forming from those who were given the drug before that period or after. That's just common sense. But many of the studies that Merrill Dow was touting did not make that distinction. So that statistical evidence was relatively shaky. Its precision shouldn't distract us from asking, is it strong or is it weak? Is it reliable or unreliable? Is it truth indicative or is it misleading? It can be perfectly true and perfectly reliable and yet misleading. You know, perhaps it is the defendant's DNA, but perhaps there's another perfectly good explanation of why it's there. Nor should it distract us from taking it in the context of all the evidence. Yup, that's hard. That's hard. That's very difficult. It's a lot harder than applying Bayes' theorem to made-up numbers. That's simple mathematics, right? Your computer will do it. Your iPhone will do it probably now. But we have a saying in English, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Well, it sounds too good to be true, doesn't it? And to give statistical evidence its true weight, there is no way to avoid this difficult and demanding task. There just isn't. You have to do it. Phew. Gracias. Muchísimas gracias.